Who's that? Warren Buffett, yeah. It's a really remarkable quote I took from him. Now, one of my more conservative friends says, yeah, well, he's complaining because he's already got his $40 billion. He wants to put higher taxes in, so I won't be able to get to that point. Well, but really has been, our distribution is our problem. The other things we're doing very well on, as far as I can see. And then the question becomes, if you mess with the distribution, will you mess up the other things, or will you not? That's an interesting question. So here's the end. I'm going to try to reconcile these views. So there we got the... And even fortune, is greed still good? I mean, it's the business community and the business press. It's not like these are, what's the word, left-wing things to wonder about the way this cuts, or right-wing or anything else. Okay, and then I have, is there a winner? Well, there's the two teams. One is the schizophrenia. I assume no one knows who these teams are. You're much too educated.
I know these guys.
Okay,
this is the Bushwhackers. Oh, that's the Legion of Doom over there.
Oh, if I had a mask to give you, that's awesome.
That's awesome. This is early 90s wrestling.
That's awesome. That's really amazing. Okay, well, so be it. Well, okay, so how do we resolve this kind of thing? We have these different views. Well, first I asked a famous physicist, and then I asked a famous economist in The Invisible Hand. You may not have seen The Invisible Hand before, and we know it knows, but it's not telling. Then I always like to say, oh my God, wait a second. There's two invisible hands. There's a left and a right. And that's because the belief that somehow or other market economics is all about right-wing views should not, that's not true. It doesn't matter in your ideological perspective, you have to respect the markets. And so they're both there, but it's not telling, so here. So now I'm gonna end with these five, I call them thoughts about trying to reconcile some of this. And I have a very nice book going through all this, if I knew what the last chapter was in putting it together, these conflicting views. The book will come out at some point. It may just end up being, well, waves and particles, and we're not as smart as the physicists, so how could we ever resolve this kind of thing? I don't know. First one I come to is, I think an awful lot of people play different roles and hire agents to be rational for them when they are not. I think of the issue of, you're in the middle of a nasty divorce proceeding, and all the emotions are pouring out of you, and who's going to get the dog? And you say, okay, God damn it, chop the dog in half. And that's just terrible. What do? You hire, well, first you should perhaps have a marriage counselor, see them, you know, and so on. But you do is you hire a lawyer. The lawyer tries to make, the lawyer has a little principal agent problem. The lawyer may get more fees by carrying on the things for a while. But presumably you do that and you get rational things. And that's all of us acting as rational even when psychologically, we're not. So I think people do this all the time. Business people, it's extraordinary. I take this honestly, and some businessmen say, I just closed the plant and all the workers went out. And all the workers lost jobs, and I had to do it because globalization told me. And, by the way, I'm giving a $100,000 gift to the Red Cross for the take care of homeless people. And I say, well, those are your workers who now don't have a job. They're homeless. And you do both things, because in one hat, you're representing the maximizing profit. The other hat, you're representing something different. That's one thing. So I think that's, and I say there is a test of this, which we haven't done, which is to do the ultimatum game, in which would you behave more like a rational person if you are in the you're representing somebody? Would you do something different in that game? Probably I should have said maybe the ultimatum. Other games is probably more important. There's dictator games, other kinds of games where you could, clearly for myself I'm willing to be psychological, but not if I'm representing all the orphans of the world. I'm gonna squeeze every penny I can get out of you because so that's one hypothesis. Then there's a similar thing, I think, of a lot of decisions we make in society. We don't let the Stanford sociology, I assume sociology department doesn't, one person doesn't make all the decisions. We have committees. Why do we set up committees to make these decisions? It's, again, it forces some rationality. If I make the decision myself, I can say, I like X, we're going to hire X. And I got to not justify it before a department. I got to stand up and say, well, X It may just be I like X, but I got to give the rationale. I've got to pretend to have some reasons. When I had this wonderful deal from Harvard, I spent about half of 5 years in London. I went to Zvi Grilicki's, and I said, that's a great possible deal, and by the way, Chicago's going to make me an offer, so they better come across. And he said, what are you going to say to Dean? I said, I'm going to go and tell the truth. He said, what's that? He says, I want to have fun in London for 5 years. I mean, it's just kind of fun, and intellectually learn about these institutions, and it's a great, great pleasure. Go ahead. Zvi says, no. You have to explain how it's going to further your academic career, your intellectual stuff. And I thought, yeah, well, that's what I meant by fun. It wasn't all the rest of the stuff. I went in and I talked to the dean and I explained, yeah, particular dean is Mike Spence. He's not here. He's not here. And I said, well, no, we can understand institutions overseas, this and this and that and that, and so on and so forth. And there was the committee that was making the thing, but it was getting advice from other people how to do that. So that also, I think, leads to more rational behavior. So we build into society knowing that people are psychologically kind of, whatever the right word is, they don't behave like economic man. We build in something. It's also in a committee, maybe you can't be totally cruel. You're a vicious kind of character. You're Mr. Greed. Screw somebody else. No. We have a lot of profits this year. Why do we want to reduce the pay of the janitors? Well, because they don't have a union here, and there are more illegal guys coming over from Mexico. We'll hire them at a lower wage. So let's, No. We have a lot of profits this year. The committee, you have to justify things in a certain way. Then the third thing is this, I call institutions learn, which I think is really missing in a lot of our analysis. The trade unions, and particularly the British ones that I know, now the FLCO finally, they're slow, to learn. They realize they're in a global world. It takes a while. They're not making the same decisions they would make X years ago. In economics, we have the Lucas kind of thing about, which basically is sort of a learning thing. You learn, you're not going to be fooled by some government inflationary stuff. Well, it's not just true of people with respect to government. These institutions build up, they learn something, and that leads to a different vision of how they are behaving in this world. If you were a union or a government that raised the minimum wage very high and a lot of people lost their jobs, that lesson is learned. You're not going to raise it that high again. You're going to be much more cautious about stuff. And that's not built into a lot of economic analysis. We haven't really built that. I said this, the biology stuff, which if I'll just leave for the moment, just saying there's a lot of work in biology that all of which says when you get groups, your group selection things, you do get a lot of the survival. And then the last thing is for Caroline's last comment, which said, what do you do about Italy? I have exactly the same problem. And so the only thing I can think of us doing is these artificial agent models where you build up very powerful simulation tools that give you a sense of what might happen and which each of the parameters. And I give you, if you don't know very much about artificial agents, this is Leah Tesfatsian. It's a website at the University of Iowa State. And she has the best website that lists all the artificial agent things and things, programs you can download, so on and so forth. And she's a wonderful, what's the right word? She's not a mainline economist. She's off to doing something different.
Sociologist.
No, she's an economist. She's a real economist. And she's actually in the math department of economics. And so she's, it's the macho in that sense, for economists and guys. But she's really devoted to this stuff, and it's a great website, great things. And then I just said, what do you think about that? If you're not familiar with this, you play computer games. You are familiar with it. Because you play, you like to play Civilization game, you play against Napoleon. Napoleon has, whatever he thinks, and you have to figure out strategies, and they've got a good computer simulation. Well, that kind of stuff can be, it's the only way, as far as I can see, you could simulate a whole economy and get some sense of what the predictions are through this. And then I point out this makes extensive demands on knowledge. And simulations that I've seen, I've dealt with the U.S. Army, which has some very interesting simulations of guerrilla warfare things. They have to do a lot. And I said, they're not of computer game quality. The graphics are really, really weak. But so be it. That's the only way I know how to deal with Caroline's problem, because we can't experiment in the real world. We have to do something with these models. And then I say, why will the end? I'm very positive. So these are the young, I said young scientists. I was going to say at one point young economists. And then I thought, that insults the rest of the social scientists. And then I thought I would say social scientists. And I said, no, because the neuro guys are helping with this, and the biology guys are really helping. And so, and you'll notice there's a man and a woman both, there's Superman and Superwoman, I suppose, to this. Because I really do think I'm very positive. I think, we got all these tools, and these computers are getting so powerful, there's so much more you can do. And then I said, through some of my favorite people, I said, they may not like whatever conclusion we reach. And this, I let my ideology come out a little bit. I think that's allowed in the last slide. I'm not going to ask him to. He knows all of these guys. But the rest of you don't know who they are. And then the answer to the people who don't like it was, here's a group of solidaristic characters saying tough noogies to you guys who get upset. So I think the answers are going to be much more in there's a lot more cooperative stuff. There's a lot more fairness things. It's going to temper considerably what has been the economics, but there's still the markets there. And I suppose I could have had some left-wing I didn't realize you had Marxist guys here. I would have had Marx here. And he was, I don't like it either or something. But I didn't. I just thought of the more conservative guys who have a particular view. Yeah. But that's, okay, that's the thought. And how you can reconcile these things you can't do it with a tough noogies little joke.
I'll just take a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a Larry's question. Do you see the U.S. economy, in general, the capitalism and nationalism sort of go hand in hand? As a transplant American, I observe that there is a competition between capitalism and nationalism in this country. Therefore, if I wear American hat, I would say the leadership of this country is only declining, even though they're not doing bad, but is that a fair assessment of election elements?
A lot of the top leadership in the country has a very globalist view. Business leadership certainly does, of capitalism. And it's not an American view. And I think it's correct. America's got a decline. As China and India come on, they've got lots of people, more people than we do. As they grow, then they have to become a larger share of world economy and become more important. America has got to decline in that sense, relatively. I think, to its credit, most of the American leadership, they won't say that. The business people will say something. They would like more scientists and engineers. They'll tell you so we can maintain some, our say in some sectors. I gave the Chinese figures to try to say, well, even as they're growing faster than us, which we all should applaud, we want the poor people to grow, the poor, we should, if we have some more of them. We're still having a lot of growth. Every family in the U.S. could have had, every person, GDP per capita, could have had $11,300 extra if we could have redistributed the money without any cost or efficiency. But, it didn't happen in the country. It was more distribution, I think, than economics. I should say I was with a group of people a few weeks ago in New York, which very much upset me. It was Bob Kuttner called a group of sort of progressives together to ask three economists to come to them. There was an awful lot of nationalism and an awful lot of protectionism. And the three economists, who were fairly left-wing, I'd say, some in our perspective, we all were against them on every single point. And I actually stood up and started yelling about, this is terrible. You want poor Indians and poor Chinese not to have growth. And yeah, it means we're declining. I think that's right. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, the reason I'm saying that is that I come from a small farming family in India.
Right.
I used electricity only at the age of 19. But thank God to my adopted mother, I grew up here as a vice president of engineering in the company and retired. So I'm grateful to Nancy from this perspective. But my question is, I still don't understand why the richest country on earth has homeless people. And I'm trying to learn, and I, by experiment, is that the ugly side of capitalism, or how would you describe that?
Let me say, that site, I studied homelessness, one of the places I did do a study, so I know something about it. Before the 1980s, we did not have very much at all. Before the 1980s, the recession, we had a big recession post the oil shock, which was the Reagan period when they were beating down the inflation. We had literally no homeless at all. We're not observable in the country. Now we have homelessness, that's absolutely right, and we've not gotten rid of it. It stayed at about 500,000, you know, it, give or take, goes up in recession, comes down a little bit in booms. Is it necessary? No. It's complicated for the following reason. One thing is with real estate markets. There used to be these boarding houses where homeless people for a dollar or two could get a place to stay. Gentrification of neighborhoods, those places don't exist anymore. So that meant so there were a set of people who could have been homeless who weren't. We also emptied a lot of the mental health institutions on the idea being it was right and left together. So it was not ideological in that sense. Felt that these people should be out and outside of, and if they took their medicines, they would be okay. They weren't. And then, you know, if the income distribution gets wider and wider, there's going to be more and more people who can't buy certain basic commodities. Do we have to have it? No. You could put a tax on the average person and we could build more. We don't have homeless. We have homeless women and children. They're all are covered. They're all in shelters and they get housing eventually. So we know that it's mostly the men whom we do not deal with. And that's, it's not necessary at all. I would say it's a social decision that we made. And the sad part of it is this, I think. When the homeless first appeared, the people were real upset in the country. I mean, it was like a livid kind of thing. How can we have homelessness in our country? We didn't have this. This is the Great Depression when people, and here we are wealthy. And then what's happened is, for some human nature reasons, we get used to it. It becomes just part of the scene, and people are less, you know, enraged about it. I have to say, because you're from India, I've never been to India, and the reason I've never been to India was because when I was a kid, I thought of India as homeless people on the streets. I thought, that's going to be so painful to see. I don't want to go to India. I didn't realize you could go to
India. I spent time in my village, and there are homeless people. I can understand the rationale.
Right, yeah.
But I don't understand the rationale for the homeless people here.
I personally think it's part of the income distribution. It's solvable if we really put our heart to it. Yeah.
Okay, so I liked your talk about what was missing from a sociological perspective is structure. So you're talking about institutions, but of course what you're actually looking at again are individuals. And you know, individuals in the sense that these are billiard balls essentially bouncing around in a giant society.
Right.
And so on one hand you have, you know, the rational actor, at least this is, you know, to paraphrase my advisor here, is the under-socialized actor. And on the other hand you have the fair team player, is a normative guy who's essentially over-socialized. And you know, which one is it? Well, it's both, but we actually can maybe by, say, looking at something like network structure, flow of information through that network structure, the ability to enforce norms, the likelihood that network structure is associated with norm internalization, then you actually have some sort of sense as to when you're going to see, you know rational hat or normative.
That's what I meant with the organization man at the end and the committees and so on.
There's a few places where you said, well, that type of enforcement requires an enormous amount of information, and I don't think it necessarily does require an enormous amount of information if you have the sort of connections that you expect within an organization.
No, I think now with the internet and so on, the information things are incredibly less expensive than they otherwise would be. And that's why I mentioned that Michael Isak's study Because now if you get you get labels that are put onto things, that's information that goes to everybody. And if SAI, which is moving towards having it, that will really help in the information flows. I think information is much less expensive than it ever was. So I didn't mean to imply that somehow the information is a great barrier to this.
Yeah. One slide you had a little sentence at the bottom that I don't actually think you read off the slide that said something like markets as tools. And something that I've been very struck by over the past few years is how much societies that are currently very different in terms of their institutional structures are willing to recognize that markets can be very useful tools.
Yes,
so that China may feel very differently about how it should organize all kinds of things, politically, all kinds of things, human rights, politics, all kinds of stuff, ready to move around the country. But they're very willing to set up markets to do at least some things because they recognize what useful tools they are. Or, you know, often if you talk to a Frenchman, the Frenchman would sort of say, okay, tell me about how I can set up a market to solve this problem. But then I'm going to actually have this market controlled by, set up by the government and controlled by the government. Whereas in the United States, you kind of say, let the market set itself up. And I've just been very struck by the fact that maybe what characterizes different economies is not so much different beliefs about markets or how people interact in markets, but really different confidence in what government is. So that there, on the one hand, there's the one extreme whose government is benevolent and has our social welfare function in mind and is trying to act it out. And so we ought to give them control of the markets as tools, and then they'll just set up the right tools. Right? And the other view, at the other extreme, you know, so the Hayek view is governments are completely self-interested too. We are extremely suspicious of them, and therefore that's why we keep them out, even if they could set up markets very efficiently. Right? That somehow it's more about what we think about governments and less about what we think about markets and schools.
No, fair enough. Can I answer her, or is this
relevant?
You're going to second that. Okay.
Yeah. I was going to add that I like to talk a lot, and I definitely see this, the whole sort of visions of capitalism very much play itself out very much in the West, but I think if you take that out of the context and look at the rest of the world, there are places where they, where this, I would say, like neoliberalism, would try to prescribe a set of policies for under so-called developed countries, and there are countries that seem to, you know, in the last few decades, some countries do well, some countries fail, and I feel like, to me, the bigger factor is actually the role of government. If you actually look at the emerging economies around the world, like India, China, and the East Asian countries, the government played a huge role. It was never sort of a free economy. Like people just, like the market role, the market corrects everything, the market just, you know, does everything on its own. It's very much sort of a very kind of calculated, controlled process of these governments consciously constructing the market for, you know, very clearly articulated goals. So I was just wondering, you know, I feel like it's a really good example for the West, but there's also this like non-West context where these things also play out, and they seem to maybe provide even better pieces because they, you know, naturally could go a little more extreme than the original model.
No, fair enough. They're both connected. They're both connected to the government, and it's it's kind of it's interesting in the following sense, because in the U.S. context, it's how you feel about towards federalism, in large part. And what we've seen is the Bush administration. We thought at one point, I'm very for federalism, local government initiatives. The more we can give power to the states to do things, I prefer that, because then you can experiment and you can see things. That traditionally was a conservative view. The Bush administration has been trying to stop states from trying things, whether you like them or not. You know, you may like what California Governor Schwarzenegger wants to do, or what. We did have a governor, I just have forgotten his name, who put in some healthcare things, because I believe he now has advertisements that say, I was never a governor of Massachusetts. I have no connection to that. But Romney actually did some things working to try to deal with the healthcare problem. He was a reasonable governor in dealing with things before he started running for president, so denying that he was a reasonable man. reasonable guy. Those were the my states. We know the Bush administration tried to stop it. I mean, they tried to harm. So I am very much favorable to lower level government stuff, because then we have a little market in governments that lets us do something more. The other issue is, are the governments, I think Korea. I think you're absolutely right. The World Bank and the East Asia report, when they gave this report a few years back, they just basically backed off completely from the claims that these countries were growing without any, they were just following market rules. No, that was not Korea. Singapore is as close to socialist state as you can get in terms of government planning, lots of stuff. Hong Kong maybe was more totally free market.
And what I'm saying recently is like keeping articles about how African countries, the ones, those small pieces of them that actually go against global bank policies tend to have produced better economic results just by ignoring.
That could very well be. World Bank is in a big frazzle over these things. But it's also true that some of the African countries went down a socialist, government-run route and were disasters. But, so so you wouldn't want to go in Africa. The countries that followed the World Bank were disasters, and the ones that did exactly the opposite were great successes. There were some bad things on both sides. The way the World Bank interpreted the East Asian thing was to say, well, they had good government bureaucracies, and were actually correct, and we can't have that in other countries. They won't do that. I think at this moment, I didn't want to get too much into the Washington Consensus kind of stuff. I spent a lot of time with the World Bank. They are really confused. They know that lots of things they were selling did not work in lots of countries, and it works in some, and they don't know what to be selling. I think Danny Roderick has this piece called Washington Consensus, sort of turns into Washington Confusion. And it's also true of the IMF. Those agencies are much more honest. The evidence is in. They know that what they were preaching did not work as well as they thought it was. Some of it didn't work at all. And the question is what alternative you're going to develop, and that it's not so easy what the alternative is.
Unfortunately, we've got the call to a close, but I want to thank you.